afternoon today.
Finish off.
And move through the agenda as quickly as we can. Do you have the witness sheets on those? So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3341. Colleagues, we heard part of this bill yesterday. The idea here is obviously to complete the testimony on this issue for the people who were not able to appear and testify yesterday. And it doesn't look like we have very much in the way of testimony on 3341. I'd ask Kathleen Haley from the Board of Medical Examiners to come forward. And we can get your comments on the record, Kathleen, if that's all right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And I appreciate that you were allowing me to come and testify on this bill this afternoon. The board wishes just to voice its concerns about some elements of the bill. At the same time, the board does support the need for malpractice reform, including measures that would eliminate any frivolous cases. But the passage of 3341, we're not sure, is the answer to solve the problem. We believe that it would be a dramatic shift for the board that licenses, investigates, and disciplines physicians and other health professionals to then go into the insurance business. It would not only shift the insurance responsibilities to the board, but it would also spread the cost among all the licensees. And remember that we license and discipline not just physicians and podiatrists, but also acupuncturists and physician assistants. So this cost would be spread throughout those professions under this bill. And this is in spite of the fact that some of the specialties, particularly some of the high-risk specialties in the physician arena, have much higher risks, elements of risks than others. And we took the PLF fund of the bar and used that as a comparison for us just to get some kind of a ballpark figure for you on what the cost would be. So we looked at it, and it would be a doubling of our personnel by adding about 35 new positions. So we're concerned about the potential fiscal impact, which we conservatively estimate to be about $21 million in the first two biennia. So this would be a significant increase in license assessments. And again, we just took the PLF figures and carried them over to us, and the coverage under the PLF is less than many of the large awards we do see in medicine. And I'm not sure the bar was aware in drafting this bill, but we have had a physician assistant program available since 1990. It's called the Health Professionals Program, and it's separate from the board's office itself, and it's used to assist licensees with substance abuse issues. In addition, we work with some private nonprofits on other programs to help remedy potential liability problems down the road. At this point, I am happy to answer any questions that you might have, and I'm sure you'll give good care in considering this dramatic public policy shift.
Thank you, Ms. Haley. Are there questions for Ms. Haley or about this bill or how it would interface with the operation of the Board of Medical Examiners? Hearing none, thank you very much
for your
testimony, Kathy.
Thank you.
Ms. Haley was, the only person signed up for the bill this afternoon that we had heard part of yesterday. Is there anyone else who wants to speak to House Bill 3341 before I close the public hearing? Okay, the public hearing is closed. The next bill we had on the agenda was House Bill 3386, and no one signed up to testify on House Bill 3386. We also had this bill up yesterday, but we're providing an additional day for anyone who wanted to testify. Before I waste the time of opening the public hearing on House Bill 3386, is there anyone here who came down to testify on that bill? Oh, Mayor Tory, are you here for that bill?
No.
Acknowledging. Oh, well, quit waving from the dais. You're screwing things up.
I don't want to get the mayor in trouble.
Just for that, Jim, you got to come up and testify on House Bill 3386.
Chair, I don't want this man ever attending an auction for me.
All right. Anybody other than Mayor Tory who wants to testify on House Bill 3386? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll move on to the next order of business. That's House Bill 2581, and I'll open a public hearing, and I'll ask Representative Ackerman to present. And do you want to be joined with Mayor Tory?
I have two guests here.
Please bring them forward.
Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Williams, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Ackerman. I am a state representative from House District 13. I am here as a co-chief sponsor of House Bill 2581, and obviously I'm here in support of that bill. My other co-chief sponsor is Representative Pat Farr, who I understand is home ill today and could not be here. The bill should be before you. Why it's important that we're expanding the terms of this bill is because our municipalities and other governing bodies frequently engage in projects which involve expenditures of vast sums of money. Typical examples may include financing arrangements for capital construction of infrastructure, including sewers, sewer systems, roads, buildings, and related facilities. In each instance, our municipalities and public agencies are vulnerable to lawsuits, which may subsequently challenge the authority of the governing body's ability to engage in these projects. Other challenges may be based on constitutional grounds. Our governing bodies, therefore, may be subject to severe financial liability if their action is overturned by these lawsuits after there has been a significant expenditure of public funds. One notable example, which I participated in the early 1980s, was a challenge to the authority of the Washington Public Power Supply System to construct nuclear generating facilities in the state of Washington. Litigation was begun in Oregon and was ended in the state of Washington, in which the courts in Washington ruled there was no authority, no charter authority for the municipalities to engage in that project. As a result, the financing, bond financing stopped. This led to the collapse of $2.2 billion in revenue bonds, which was used to finance the project, creating the largest bond default in the history of the United States. It was unusual, I think, for me to understand why the power system did not have some validation proceedings or test case before expending such a great sum of money, but this is the extreme example what we're trying to cure by this particular bill today. The purpose of this bill is to allow the municipalities or other governing bodies of state agencies to file a claim upon proper notice in circuit court to seek a validation of its actions on various grounds, including authority and constitutional issues. This bill actually amends ORS 33.710 by expanding the grounds for a validation ruling. One ground that we seek to expand it upon is to determine the authority of the municipality or the governing body to enter into such activities, and the dash two amendments which are before you extend that the scope of the legal inquiry to determine the constitutionality of such action. There's a notice provision which implements the existing statute, which is ORS 33.720. That's not a part of your packet because it's existing law. But what occurs under that notice provision is that a claim is filed in circuit court whereby a municipality or state agency seeks to validate its claims. It is actually an invitation for defendants to intervene in the case so that a justiciable controversy would be created. I think if the bill has a flaw, it's that if nobody appears, we cannot get an advisory ruling from the courts. However, legislative counsel has reported to me that on 11 or 12 occasions that they know of, where this process has been used, it has produced appropriate defendants to make a case or controversy before the court. I also spoke with a representative of the PUC yesterday, and she has informed me that the PUC recently has used this validation statute to seek a validation in circuit court, and they did find an appropriate defendant that did intervene in the process to make it a case or controversy for the court to issue a ruling on the validation issues. That's basically what we intend by this bill. As I said, it's an expansion of the bill to include the scope of these proceedings, to include authority issues and constitutional issues, and there's one catch-all clause in the event the action of the governing body involves a novel new point of law or a significant expenditure of public funds. We think this is an extension of a statute which has a good public purpose, and to the extent that we can facilitate predictability in our governmental actions by court validation proceedings, I believe that this statute should be appropriately amended by House Bill 2581 and the dash 1 and 2 amendments which you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Why don't we go ahead and allow the other two witnesses to testify before we open it up for questions. Mayor Tory?
Yes, Chair Williams and members of the committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today. I particularly appreciate the fact that Representative Ackerman brought this bill along with Representative Farr to you. I've talked to Representative Ackerman a number of times over the years about the lack of predictability in governmental activities at a city level, where after going through a series of public hearings, asking people to come in and testify either for or against a particular issue, then going through the various levels of debate that exist, whether it's a city or a county commission or a planning commission, and getting to the final decision only to have people wait until some point further down the line and then say, you know, I think we're going to bring a legal action against you and stop the process. What I hope that this bill will do will be to provide whomever wants to challenge the decision of the body to give them a venue in which they can bring their issue and then give predictability to the governing body in the event that it is accepted by the courts as an appropriate activity by that elected body, so that we don't go forward with the expenditure of large amounts of money only to find that we are kept in court year after year on an issue. I would hope that we could get that early predictability, and I can give you examples of where this has happened in the city of Eugene, that, you know, if we lose as a governmental body, we lose. But don't hang us out for that long period of time, because in many instances you start the process, whether it's a right-of-way acquisition, and then we are challenged. And then we go through the courts, and we, of course, defend the position that we've taken. I would hope that you see the value of these changes in this bill, or additions, I should say, to this bill, and the amendments that Representative Ackerman brought before you. And I would hope you can find a way to support it. I do not know of a negative aspect of this bill. And for that reason, I would appreciate very much if you would provide the predictability that local government needs in this area.
Thank you, Mayor Tory.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, Jason Huser with the City of Eugene Government Relations Office. I think the only thing I would want to add is there's a fine common sense principle in what this bill entails, and that's the idea of dealing with controversy sooner rather than later. And when we're dealing with expenditures, large expenditures of public funds, that's always in the interest of any community, and I urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Are there questions for the panel? Representative Pozanski, then Representative Jason.
Thanks, everyone, for being here. Bob, I was asked or given a note to ask a question. I'm not sure how this is going to lay out. I just want to ask if someone had a challenge on constitutionality, and are they going to be precluded from bringing that up later if they didn't have notice of the hearing or whatever was occurring, the action that occurred in court, and no one appeared at that time?
I think there is a problem, if I follow your question right, is we have a defendant raise a constitutional issue. I think there would be claim preclusion as to that issue, but maybe not to others that could have been brought. I would think, however, in shaping the litigation, that city attorney would want to, you know, shape the issue so that all issues could be litigated if we found a defendant was willing to intervene in the case.
Okay. If I could just follow up. When this was handed to me, I just read it. I'm just reading you what I've gotten. I know that there's the dash twos that talks about after on page two that we would be inserting after the word body, including constitutionality of the ordinance, resolution, and regulation. Does that make a difference in position? I'm just putting stuff on the record so we know.
I think that by putting my fear was that we might not be able to raise a constitutional issue if the statute didn't say we had the authority to do that. So I wanted to cover that.
Okay.
Constitutional issues sometimes arise in these matters because you might have a very sophisticated funding device, and it might run afoul of debt limitations that are in county charters, city charters, and we even have state constitutional debt limit. Constitutional debt limits. So sometimes we have to get rulings on those. And why that's important, of course, is for bond counsel to be able to certify that you know, bonds have been validly issued and there's no substantial litigation involving them. And if the validation proceeding finds that these procedures or these financing agreements don't violate constitutional provisions and are within the authority of the public body, then bond counsel has an easier job. As I said, you avoid bond defaults. A challenge would be so successful in the future.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Further questions, Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it seems to me like this would generate a lot of litigation. And in relationship to that, I'm curious as to what provisions are going to be necessary as far as the court system to be able to handle it, at least if the circuit court in the rest of Greater Oregon is similar to what it is in my district, you're going to be a long time getting these things in front of a judge. So I'm curious what thoughts have gone into that as to how...
I tell you about a time delay in
time
bringing it.
Yes.
Well, my feeling would be that after the governing body has initiated the project, it would produce the public notice, which is required, and that has to run, I think, for a month. I've forgotten. But I think that would have the effect of bringing people into court that wanted to go to court to challenge these things. Likewise, nothing would stop the city or other people from contacting public interest groups who would like to litigate issues of this nature. So I see it coming to as timely a conclusion as any other litigation in court. I don't think that this would take any... there's nothing inherent about this process which would take a lot of time.
I follow.
You may.
Just an observation. I think in my circuit court, it's 2 years for a civil case before you... before it gets on the docket to be heard, that would somewhat seem to be quite a lengthy period of time. But the other question, if I may, Mr. Chair, ask is the language in sentence or in E through G in section 2 of the bill, or section 1, sub 2. It is supposed to create, as I understand it, kind of a court advisory opinion. If this is true, that this what we're looking for is a court advisory opinion, is this proper? Do we have some type of a breakdown or a breach of the separation of powers in our system with this?
Yeah, Chair Williams and Representative Jensen, as I indicated in my original testimony, that is a flaw if no defendants entered in the case to make it a legal controversy the court would be invited to make an advisory opinion, which based upon the separation of powers it could not do. So basically the city could not proceed, and I don't think would proceed under those circumstances. So yes, there's a risk that someone may not want to intervene in the case. On the other hand, the municipalities and other governing bodies tell me they want this tool because they feel it can be used effectively, as it has been reported to me that by legislative council that has been used successfully 11 or 12 times that they can determine. That is, people have actually come in and made it a case or controversy for a full-blown judicial decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And excuse me for the being unable to follow the legal gibberish as we cruise on this.
This is a committee of gibberish and technicality.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We appreciate your endurance, Representative Jensen, and your assistance. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things, if I may. First, speaking of gibberish, and also to get at Representative Jensen's concern about the timeliness of this, I'm looking at the statute that immediately follows this in the series that's not in the bill but is in the memo. And get this language. It says that such proceeding shall be tried forthwith and judgment rendered as expeditiously as possible, declaring the matter so contested to be either valid or invalid. Any order or judgment in the course of such proceeding may be made and rendered by the judge in vacation or otherwise, and for that purpose the court shall be deemed at all times to be in session, and the act of the judge in making the order or judgment shall be an act of the court. This has got to come from a long time ago.
That's why I went to law school, Representative.
Yeah.
I just love the way that sounds.
Mr. Chair, maybe
but I had one serious question. What?
Put that on the law commission's agenda.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised, Dale. You know, this statute was amended in 2001. I can't believe they didn't go back through and
take out the forthwith.
Yeah. And expeditious or judges on vacation render a decision. But the question I...
And that's why you went to law school.
The question I had was the issue was this question of claim preclusion or issue preclusion, I guess. And that is an interesting one because I can see, of course, it would not be the city of Eugene, but I could see that some city might find a cooperative defendant to mm-hmm. file an appearance or a contest to join the matter for court determination if nobody else wants to join that. And then I guess the question of claim preclusion or issue does become an issue. And I guess for my own purposes, if somebody can help me, that's not an absolute rule, is it? The courts, don't they usually look at whether the issue was appropriately argued and briefed and by parties having an interest in it at whatever previous venue the issue was decided at?
I think you're right, Representative, in that there is a you have to sort of match up the rights of the individual litigants to make a determination as to whether or not there's a fit there. And I don't think it is an absolute rule. Although it's one that the court regularly uses to dispose of having to hear a matter for a second time if they feel like it's been appropriately addressed.
If I may, yeah, we're adding in here, for instance, the determination of constitutionality of an ordinance or a resolution, and I could see somebody not even being aware that a particular resolution is being adopted, and then a year later or 2 years later this resolution is being enforced against them, and they may all of a sudden have occasion to want to take a look at it and raise a question of constitutionality, I suppose, and be surprised to find that there was a notice in the legal an ad in the legal notices published a year and a half ago that gave them the opportunity to challenge that, and never suspecting that it might be enforced against them, and then find that in fact there was a discussion of that, and it's already been decided against them. I don't know. I'm looking for some comfort there that the courts would be reluctant, I think, to apply any kind of preclusion doctrine in that scenario.
Representative, to respond, I'll just say that I had interestingly on this similar topic in a different venue with a member of the Supreme Court, which will be nameless right now because I don't want to out him. But we had this very same conversation about whether or not in a can you take away someone's right to essentially challenge an as-applied constitutional challenge? And, you know, the sense was that you can't. That you can't put a procedural mechanism in place that denies that individual their right to make their argument that as applied, something is unconstitutional. What you can do is take away all sorts of the procedural challenges through a period of time that often are the things that tie up a local government when these things have been acted upon and then later someone wants to come back and challenge them. But Representative Ackerman?
Yes, Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, in answer to Representative Shetterly's question, it would be my thought that counsel for the governing body would craft the complaint in such a way as to anticipate all of these issues, whether it be constitutional issues or authority issues, and actually put it in the complaint so that in the event somebody intervened in the case, at least there was an opportunity to have those issues joined at that point. I think that's how I would advise counsel to proceed on these, to raise every issue possible to avoid any issue or claim preclusion argument at a later time. I also agree with Representative Shetterly's observation that in some instances, in my study of this from long, long ago, these cases were collusive cases where the plaintiff's governing body would go out and find a couple of people that would come in and they'd be nominal defendants, they'd pay their legal fees, and this is an alternative to that because I have a it's hard for me to overcome the ethical considerations of a collusive lawsuit, yet we do have a necessity for validation proceedings that can be advanced by the municipality or the governing body at the earliest possible time.
Further questions? Representative, Mayor Corey, you want to?
You know, I'm not going to quit raising my hand. No,
That's
how I got into this position in the first place. Anybody want this job? And I said, yeah.
You just go to a public meeting, and the next thing you know, you're mayor.
But what I really followed up with, Chair Williams, is I didn't identify myself, and I always get in trouble if I don't do that. My name is Jim Torrey, and I am the mayor of the city of Eugene. And Chair Williams and Representative Przanski, if I had been bidding on something, I would have sent you a bill. Thank you very much.
You bet.
One last thing I'll put on. We're not trying to play I gotcha here. What we're really trying to do is, look, you have been to a number of meetings where they say, look, if you pass this ordinance, we're going to bring a legal action against you. Fine, let us show you how to do that. And you come in and tell us if it's right or wrong, so we can proceed with the process, or not. Thank you again.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. We have three other witnesses. Andrea, and it's Fogg. Did I get it right? Okay. And Linda Lynch from the Lane Transit District. And Paul Snyder from AOC. And Paul indicated that he had a Ways and Means commitment and that if he wasn't able to testify, he would submit his testimony in writing, which the committee will receive. So if you both want to come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. Usually you see Christy Monson's face before you, but I'm filling in today. So it's a privilege to be here, and if you'll indulge me, my comments are brief. You've heard the testimony of the mayor and Representative Ackerman. First off, I would like to thank Representative Ackerman and Representative Farr for bringing this bill forward. This is something that the League supports. We think that it can be very helpful in terms of helping us be efficient in terms of issues that are going to be a significant cost to the public and getting a sense of where any legal concerns might lie before those issues are moved forward. And so, again, we think this bill would be very helpful, and we urge your support.
Okay, thank you, Andrea. Representative Shetterly, are you?
No, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Okay.
Just wait.
All right, great. Ms. Lynch?
Yes. I'm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Linda Lynch. I'm the Government Relations Manager for Lane Transit District. We just came today. I submitted a letter in support. Just wanted to say cities aren't the only ones who enact ordinances, and some of the ordinances that we enact govern behavior on transit property, and those can be controversial and raise constitutional questions, which have taken us to court. And this would be an efficient method of reviewing ordinances that do that. It would be very helpful to us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there questions for either of these witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sheriff.
Can I can I wave to Linda with having her bet on anything?
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. Anything else?
I didn't buy anything, did I?
Yeah, you just did. You'll get the bill on your way up. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, and Andrea Meyer. Okay, go ahead. You two are excused, and Andrea Meyer representing the ACLU.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I think a number of you have touched on our concerns where this could potentially go, and I'm not sure what the answer is to safeguard the issue of constitutional questions being raised, being fully and adequately litigated on the front end, such that if they come up again in the future, that there's really truly an opportunity because of issue preclusion, claim preclusion, and the other things that Representative Shirley and I all sort of vaguely recall from law school, but can't always walk our way through, how those could affect the ability to bring up a constitutional claim later. So, you know, we are neutral on this, but raise that concern and don't know how we can flesh that out a little bit better.
Okay.
What's that for testimony from me?
Well, it's sort of right there in the middle, which doesn't give us a whole lot of direction, unfortunately.
No,
but I'll give you, I'll turn you over to Representative Ackerman to ask you questions. Do you have any for her?
No, I have no questions.
Oh, okay. All right.
Chair Rollins, I just wanted to go on the record. I mean, I think you've all adequately discussed this, and I'm not sure that anyone really has the answer, and I just, a word of caution is all in how we can, because I do understand the interests and what Representative Ackerman is trying to achieve, and I just worry about those odd situations that could arise with that aren't the intention of good parties like Eugene or others that want to truly address these issues.
Okay. Are there questions for Ms. Meyer? Okay. Hearing done. Thanks, Adrian. Let me say this. Because we have this question about the issue and claim preclusive effect of the suit, why don't we agree to not move the bill into work session today, but to ask somebody from Legislative Counsel's office to come up and talk to the committee about how this would impact that issue? Does that sound reasonable?
Fine.
Representative, I think that might cause everybody to be comfortable or at least figure out if there is something we need to do to address the issue and claim preclusion impacts to make sure that we're not going to step on it down the road. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2589. And I'll ask counsel to arrange for someone from LC to come up and talk to us about that issue, and we'll get the bill back on for work session the first part of next week. Does that sound reasonable?
Fine.
Okay. With that, we'll move now to House Bill 2694. And I have signed up on the witness sheet Ron Moore and Burl Scheibe. Did I get that right? Scheibe? Welcome, gentlemen. Which one of you wishes to start?
Well, I'll start it off, if you don't mind, Representative Chair Williams. I'm Ron Moore, for the record, Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association. We're located here in Salem, Oregon. We are a for-profit trade association representing farm equipment dealers and outdoor power equipment dealers in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And with me is Burl Scheibe, and Burl will introduce himself.
I'm Burl Scheibe, a partner with the Fisher Ernst Group Implement Dealerships throughout the Willamette Valley. We're primarily John Deere dealerships, and because of our diversity, we have a multitude of different types of manufacturers that we do business with and distributors, and I'm here to answer any questions as how it relates to dealerships.
Okay, great. You want to proceed, Mr. Moore? Tell us what this bill does.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. Thank you for taking time today to hear from the association and about the bill. It does several things. It talks about the mandatory repurchase of inventory, parts, special tools, signage, computer equipment upon termination of a dealer agreement. And I guess that'll let you know that today the farm equipment dealers operate in agreement with the manufacturers and suppliers. That may be in writing, that may be oral, and it's basically an agreement of adhesion. It's presented to the dealer. If he wants it, he can sign it. If he doesn't, he doesn't. And there's not a lot of negotiation, not a lot of alternatives. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, if a dealer did not want to take a product line, he had a lot of choices. Today, the majors are consolidated down to John Deere, CNH Global, which is Case, IH, and New Holland, and AGCO. And so there's not a lot of opportunity to make a different selection. So upon a termination of an agreement by a manufacturer, this bill defines the repurchase of the inventory, the parts, signage, special tools, and computer hardware and software. We have some language that's new that talks to the issue if there is an action brought on a dealer that it will be in this state. And I do want to make a comment, Chair, that we do have some amendments to offer today, if that's all right. And that's one area we'd like to make an amendment. The bill specifies what action the supplier with the dealer, the supplier rather cannot coerce the dealer to take special equipment and to receive product and so forth upon the dealer's manufacturer's request. The bill addresses succession rights. This is kind of an important area for us upon either death of an owner or if the dealer has a buyer. Typically, these suppliers like to dictate the buyer, and we're not going to be able to change that situation, but we are going to ask that if there's a willing buyer and a willing seller and the buyer qualifies, that the supplier will put in writing the reasons for refusing the deal. The good cause provisions are to remain the same. However, we're going to increase the fact that the supplier will bear the burden of proving that a dealer's area of responsibility or trade area doesn't afford sufficient sales to support the dealership, if they're going to use that as a reason for termination, and that too will be put in writing, and the burden of proof will be upon the supplier. We're going to ask that the arbitration section, that the rules be conducted by the American Arbitration Association rules, and we do like the opportunity to go to arbitration. In Section 8, we talk about the relevant market of the dealership, and sometimes the manufacturers will establish new dealers within a dealer's trade territory. We're asking not that they don't do that particularly, but if they are going to do that, that they notify the existing dealers. Some new language deals with warranty and warranty compensation. This bill will address that. It asks that the manufacturers or the suppliers pay the going labor rate that the dealer charges for non-warranty work. And we talk about product improvement. Several times the suppliers may ask a dealer to go out and do improvements to machines. And usually the dealer is asked to pick up the tab for that. We think that, you know, if it's a product improvement, it's a manufacturer's responsibility. They can help pay the labor. And if it's for safety, then they should pick up the transportation cost to do that also. So those are some of the highlights. Chair Williams, I did mention we have some amendments to offer today that have recently been negotiated with some of the suppliers. So I don't know when you might want those to be offered.
Well, and I think we've got those are the dash ones.
No, these I have. No, they're not. They're in addition to the dash ones.
They're in addition to the dash ones.
As recently as Wednesday, as recently as Monday night conversation with the governmental affairs director for John Deere. We agreed some amendments.
I think it would be important for the committee to know that is this, with those amendments, does this become a consensus bill?
You know, I shouldn't speak for the manufacturers, but my sense and understanding is that it would be. And I know they're not here today, but
yeah, I was going to say they haven't signed up.
No,
so you get a free shot at speaking for them.
Well,
they're not going to come speak for themselves.
As I mentioned earlier this morning to one person, there's a bit of an integrity issue, and so I can't speak for the manufacturers, but it's my sense that I have language that they are comfortable with. In fact, one in particular amendment that I'd like to offer is at their request. So, and I have a note from Jerry Parkin with John Deere that says if that's offered, he's in agreement.
And are we in the process of getting the amendments drafted?
Well, these are I have copies if you'd like those. I brought those with me. These are oral amendments being offered today due to the lateness of the situation. So you tell me how to proceed. We'll be glad to do it.
Okay, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Moore, I think when you and I spoke, you had indicated that this bill represents kind of a movement that's going through Western states and is an agreement between the suppliers, the manufacturers, and the dealers that's slowly being adopted in each of the states. So it's generally starting from a consensus point of view, correct?
That's fairly correct, yes. And we started this process 2 years ago in the state of Washington, and most of these amendments to the Oregon statutes are what we passed in the state of Washington. Spent 2 years negotiating that, which made this process a little quicker, but still needed some negotiations.
Representative Shetterly, I suspect you represent at least one farm implement.
Mr. Chair, I'm on the board of directors of Rickreall Farm Supply.
Are you?
Yeah. So I worked.
Congratulations.
I've worked with this statute. Well, I do have a couple of questions.
Yes,
about these amendments.
One else.
Yeah, I understand they're going to be worked in, but a couple things that I would want to make sure that we cover, if I may.
Okay.
You may.
I'm looking at this. I notice on page 3 of the -1 amendments, and this is something I think ought to be clarified in whatever new amendments are coming through. On line 25 of the -3, it says on page 2, delete lines 1 through 29. If you look at page 2, that leaves an extraneous line 30, which is the latter part of the definition of warranty claim. It's the last line of the definition of warranty claim on line 30. And a little bit confusing about that is if you look up on lines 22 through 24 of the -3 amendments.
The -3 amendments?
Of the -3 amendments, that last line 30 could actually fit right at the end of the definition of warranty claim on the -3. So I'm not sure whether line 30 is supposed to be in or out.
Give me the -1s. We don't
I'm sorry, I'm looking at page 3. Sorry,
what, page 3 on the
sorry,
-1.
Sorry, page 3 okay. -1s.
Page 3.
So the -1s, page 3, line 25, leave line 30 on page 2 of the bill in place. And that just seems kind of strange. You see where I am?
Well, it's what it means is it would just, on line 22 where it says sub 17 warranty claim.
Right.
You would read that all the way through, and then you would have this stray line essentially that just says
For service or part
provided to a customer under warranty.
And the odd part, Mr. Chair, is that that could actually be the conclusion even of the new definition of warranty claim.
Well, but it would
but they put a period there.
But it would repeat it twice.
Yeah, okay. Well,
because it would say for service or parts provided to a customer under a warranty.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah. So they must have just left out.
They must have just left out line 30.
As a part of the deletion.
As part of the deletion.
And if I may, there's one other thing that's just a little odd.
Can we pause for a second?
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to keep up with you.
All right. Let me show you where to look. On page 3 of the -1 amendments, do you have the -1s in front of you?
I do. And on line 25, it says on page 2 of the bill.
Right.
Correct.
Lines 1 through 29. And if you look at the bill, page 2, line 1 through 29, it would leave a stray line on line 30. So they just need to... That needs to go one more line for the deletion. Otherwise, you have a orphaned line there.
I catch your drift.
Okay.
And the other thing, if I may?
You may.
Just, again, as long as they're working on the amendments.
Okay.
I must
express a concern in that I'm not sure we want to delete all of that, but...
Well, we're not sure
you
do either.
Yeah.
We're pointing out that at least the amendment isn't currently tracking with the bill.
Well, this has been difficult.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. I think it's on page 8
of the bill.
Of the bill and page 4 of the dash 1 amendments. And this is just a stylistic thing, but something to look at. If you start at line 15 of the dash 1 amendments.
Page 4.
Page 4, line 15 of the dash 1 amendments.
Page 8. Yeah.
It amends page 8, line 8,
mm-hmm.
where it would say good cause means a retailer's colon.
Right.
Careful.
That's what I can hear. So, yeah.
More of that gibberish.
Yeah, more. Colon, and then you'd have A. Failure to comply. Failure to comply. And then B would be transferring. C would be making. D would be filing. There's just a stylistic thing there where the A, B, C, and D don't speak the same language.
I might make a comment that on page 8 of the bill, on line 15, where it starts with all the good cause provisions, and those were excluded. I have no understanding of why those were excluded to start with, and this is supposedly an effort to put those back in.
Okay, that seems to work.
The style is not our style. I don't know.
Right.
You understand that?
Do you know where the Dash 1 amendments came from?
Well, they came from our request to kind of put this thing back in order. There was things that were deleted and changed that were not requested.
Okay.
From us.
Yeah.
And I guess what I would say, Chair Williams, is that if we could get a consolidated, engrossed version to go through again to make sure everything's up to speed, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm going to do, I'm going to recommend that you work with Mr. Joseph to take your current amendments down to the Legislative Council and set up a little meeting down there and go over the Dash 1s and your current amendments with them to combine into a set of amendments that you think satisfies everybody, and then so we don't spend any more committee time talking about dealers' colons, I'm going to have you talk to Representative Shetterly, because you so earned place to know a lot about this bill, and I'm going to ask you to sort of triangulate with him to answer any issues that he wants to raise before we have the bill back in front of the committee. Does that sound?
I think it's as the representative Rickerall, he's the one.
Yeah, he is.
We'll plow through it.
He's
just be careful not plowing through the retailer's colon.
So, Chair Williams.
Yes, and we haven't even given poor Mr. Scheibe a chance to say anything. Do you want to say anything?
I was going to make some comments about plowing through this, but I see that's well underhand. I was just here mainly for any clarification, any questions that might come up.
Okay.
From a dealer standpoint.
All right. I think we've. I'm not even going to try to.
You farmed it out to me.
Yeah, I have.
To implement the.
I'm closing it right now. House Bill 2694, the public hearing is closed. Thank you, and work with Mr. Joseph.
Thank you.
I spent a lot of time playing your straight man.
You did a good job on it.
We're going to go to a work session on House Bill 2066. And, colleagues, this bill has a plethora of amendments, in part because of its nature as a bill relating to courts, and some consideration of things we were wanting to look at doing, which we probably are going to hold off on and address some of these issues in another relating to courts bill that we have in committee. So you don't be too panicked by the fact that you see dash 16 amendments. I think what we ought to do, counsel, is just ask the courts to come up and walk us through their version of the amendments.
I forgot my file and my SMS.
Okay, so if you want to come on up, Brad, and just talk us through the amendments that at least you're familiar with on this bill.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, special counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department. I am aware of two sets of amendments that we are concerned about. As you may remember, When I last spoke to you about this bill, I think on January 22nd, this bill does several things, sort of smooths out several bumps, statutory bumps, that make it easier for the OJD, to the Oregon Judicial Department, to do its work and remove some of them. Two of them caught the committee's attention. One of them was in Section 1 of the bill that removed provisions that mandated that courts schedule a trial when somebody failed to appear. And the committee was concerned that somebody not lose their right to a trial, to request a trial in those circumstances, and wanted language to make that clear. And the other issue that the committee raised was in Section 10 of the bill that talk about judicial oaths. The committee, rather than having the Chief Justice adopt an oath by court rule or Chief Justice order, wanted them to be in the statute. And both of those are fine. And the Dash 15 amendments accomplish both of those purposes that were raised by the committee. Make some adjustments to Section 1, add a new Section 1A, and then add a new Section 6 that sets out judicial oaths and which judicial oaths which judges take, and there are actually three in that, and that's the way that David Hendricks worked out. But they're all closely modeled after the constitutional provisions, some of them with some tweaks, because we've got some judges who are appointed, some that are elected, some that are full-time, some that are part-time, and so that's how he worked out that particular issue with O's. So that's the Dash 15 amendments that I'm aware of, to take care of the committee's concerns. The Dash 16 amendments, which we're also supporting, are a set of amendments to take care of an issue that came up during the interim. Last session, the legislature put together in the Judicial Department a collections and revenue management program, and for a short time there was an interesting controversy about the legislative intent behind part of that program, and this amendment puts into statute the legislative intent that was in controversy, and in fact makes the statute consistent with what we did that was consistent with that understanding of legislative intent, and may solve some problems in terms of people who were arguing about what we should be doing with that. So it cleans up and makes consistent some language in the statute that deals with our collections and revenue management program. We recommend both the Dash 15 and Dash 16 amendments to you. Even with adding these amendments, we note that that House Bill 2066, in our estimation, has no fiscal impact. It just clears up bumps in the road, makes things a little more efficient, provide for some long-term cost avoidance, and we note that there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this that you may not need. I can answer any questions that you've got.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanchez.
I just want a clarification. Brad, when you're talking Dash 16, I'm assuming you're talking about the ones that are actually marked as Dash 16. There's another one that's in here that says Dash 14 that has in writing outside Dash 16.
Representative Williams, Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, we actually got a copy of the Dash 14s at about 11 o'clock this morning and noted a problem with them. The Dash 16s are the corrected Dash 14s, but we weren't sure that there was going to be time for Legislative Council's office. We sent the Dash 14s with the markups, or what we sent down to Legislative Council's office. The Dash 16s are what they sent back in response to that. Okay. Solves the problem we'd spotted, and that's...
So we disregard the ones that are...
Disregard them, right.
Dash 14.
Yes.
Are there other questions for Mr. Swank? Representative Barker?
Thank you. Mr. Swank, on the 15s, the oaths of office, is this going to resolve the problem? I know up in Multnomah County they're having the people, I guess is nice I can put it, that are saying judges have no authority because they didn't do a tap dance or something when they took the oath, or they took the wrong oath, or they left out a word or something. They should take care of those problems.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, I'm always intrigued by some of the free-thinking citizens of the state of Oregon. A part of my desk in my day job is dealing a lot with those groups, because everybody says, oh, you know, Brad can do that. We introduced this in hopes of heading in the direction of solving these problems. I'm not sure that it's a foolproof plan because people are so inventive. Particularly that group is fascinating, but that's the reason this is there, to move in that direction and to help solve the problem and clear up a lot of the plethora of issues surrounding that. And I certainly hope that it takes a lot of that off our plate because it consumes a lot of time.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Brad, can you tell us, just so we understand, how the definition, the oath definition, differs in what we're looking at versus, in fact, I just opened the constitutional section. Is it only the Supreme Court judge's oath that's in the Constitution, Brad?
Well, actually, there are two oaths for Supreme Court justices in the Constitution. One's in the original Article 7, one's in the amended Article 7. They're a little different. There is also a provision in Article 15 that applies to all elected officials. So the way that David Hendricks, who drafted these amendments, addressed that was to just in Section 6, and if you're looking at the Dash 15 amendments, it's lines 17 through 20 on page 1, is just to refer to the constitutional oath in the amended Article 7, which is the one that we all believe they should be taken because that was the replacement provision. Judge of the Court of Appeals, the Order Tax Court, or a Circuit Court, a person who's appointed, which would be by the governor, or elected for the office, the oath is set out, except for some of the misspellings that are in the constitutional provision. That is very similar, and there are also some blanks in places. It's similar to the Article 7 oath, except there are some blanks in places where you're not swearing or affirming to carry out the duties of the Supreme Court, but it would be whatever court that you were being appointed or elected to. And then in the Article 7 oath amended, it says elected, and you're looking, I'm on page 2, line 9, and this provides the option, so that's of elected or appointed, because in fact some of them do initially get appointed. And then for the pro tempore oath and senior judge oath, which starts on page 2, line 15 of the Dash 15 amendments. The distinction, it's exactly like the one above, except the last line, it leaves out the words, except, and I will not accept any other office except judicial offices during the term for which I have been elected or appointed. It stops, that phrase is out, and it stops with ability. And the reason for that is because both senior judges and what we call lawyer judges, and these are the pro tems. It's not where you have, say, a circuit court judge from Multnomah County being appointed to do pro tem work in Douglas County. That's a judge, pro tem judge. But we've got lawyer judges. We've got actually lawyers in Douglas County who get approved by the Supreme Court to serve as pro tem judges, and they get approved for 3-year periods and appointed then during a single year period to serve for a certain amount of time. Well, during the time that they're not serving an appointment, they're actually allowed by law to go back and carry on their practice. So for them to swear or affirm that they wouldn't accept other office would be problematic. So for the lawyer pro tems and the senior judges who are in the same situation, they don't have to swear to not accept any other office because, of course, they're allowed by law to. And that's how that... Does that help, Chair Williams?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I've read both the Article 7 amended Section 7 oath and the Article 7 original Section 21 oath. And, you really have to parse them out to find the distinctions, but I think you've described them well. I mean, this is, just for the committee's benefit... The original constitutional article had an oath that just simply said, I blank do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of a judge of the Supreme and Circuit's courts of said state according to the best of my ability, and that I will not accept any other office except judicial offices during the term for which I have been elected. So it tracks fairly closely, fixing some of the spelling and acknowledging that not all our judges are elected, but some are appointed until they are reelected. And then similarly in the That was the original. And amended, it says, I blank do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of a judge of the Supreme Court of this state according to the best of my ability, and that I will not accept any other office except judicial offices during the term for which I have been elected. So, I mean, this oath that we're going to statutorily put in place and require, I think, tracks fairly closely to the oath that's required either by Article 7, amended or original. And then obviously the distinction being made for those that are serving in pro tem capacities and the like, which are covered in the second version of the oath. So it seems to satisfy me, colleagues, and I think it's actually my take is it's better to put it in the statute as opposed to allow it to be subject to an oath prepared by the Chief Justice, because I think that only opens up the argument that people are making now, that the court can define its own oath, and that's different than this. And I think this gives them the opportunity to argue that the legislature dictated to them what oath they were going to have to administer, having reviewed the oaths and that were in the Constitution. So that's my take on it. Any thoughts or questions? Okay. How about on the dash 16s? Are there any questions on the impact of the dash 16 amendments that you have for Mr. Swank? Okay. We're in work session. I want to make sure that we, I think it's my intent not to move the bill out today, only because I want to make sure that as we're getting close to the deadline that there isn't anything else that we need to put in this bill before we send it on its way, and I want to cross-check a couple of other points. But I think it makes sense, having had the discussion, to go ahead and adopt both the dash 15 and dash 16 amendments at this point, so they're in the bill. If we don't need to revisit it, we can just bring it back up and move it forward. So the chair would move the adoption of the dash 15 amendments to House Bill 2066.
Are you moving?
I just moved it, yeah. Are you okay?
I'm fine with both.
All right. Okay, so I move the adoption of the dash 15 amendments. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? The dash 15s are in, showing Representatives Shetterly and Anderson excused. And the chair would move the adoption of the dash 16 amendments to House Bill 2066. Any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Okay, the dash 16s are in, also showing Representative Shetterly and Anderson is excused. So with those amendments in the bill, it's my intent to close the work session on House Bill 2066, and we'll put this on for next week to make sure we haven't missed anything, and then we'll move it forward. So we'll close the work session now on House Bill 2066. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2150. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You recall House Bill 2150 specifies that a copy of a small estate affidavit must be mailed or delivered to the Estate Administration Unit of the Department of Human Services. This bill originally came about to clarify where these were to go. And also had some provisions regarding petitions for summary determination and also the final deadline for filing was within 2 years. A petition for summary review was allowed within 2 years of the filing of the small state affidavit. We have dash one amendments. Which fixed some technicalities in the law, but otherwise I think it's ready to go.
And we have gentlemen from the division here. Do you want to come up and tell us what the dash one amendments do to 2150? And remind us why we chose not to move the bill out the last time you were in front of us?
Thank you, Chairman Williams. The dash one amendments on this was at the request of the Oregon Judicial Department. What we had done in the original draft of the bill was we requested to start a clock, if you will, ticking on mailing of a notice to the court. And the Judicial Department had a number of procedural concerns about that, and the department didn't feel that that what we were trying to address was a big enough problem to impose an additional burden on the Judicial Department. So we agreed to delete that requirement, and that's what the Dash 1 amendments are about. To be real honest, I'm not exactly sure why the bill didn't move out after the public hearing last time. Oh, by the way, for the record, my name's Rick Mills with Department of Human Services. Sorry about that.
Thanks, Rick, for clarifying that. Everybody remember this bill from last time?
I have a note that says probably going back for amendments is what I wrote on.
Yeah. I have some very sketchy notes, Mr. Chair, and an issue identified was what that the concern that this was going to leave open for a longer time than need be the closing of an estate, I think, was the issue. And I have a sketchy note that says, suggested solution, ultimate repose at later of 2 years after death or 6 or 9 months after filing of affidavit.
Yeah, I've got a... There was a Jeff Bernhardt, I think, here from the bar that testified.
Right. I have his...
His testimony?
Yeah.
And there was an issue about certifying copies. You'll go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't want to presume too much.
No. Presume that it's we've had probably 100 bills up since the last time we looked at yours, and we're all trying to remind ourselves what we had concerns about.
Chair Williams, first of all, to clarify for the record, Jeff Bernhardt was not here as a representative of the elder law section of the Oregon Bar. He was here as a representative of the law firm of Ney and Friedenberg. The problem is, I don't know how to put this delicately or diplomatically, but he was raising an issue of ultimate repose, wherein as that two-year requirement that he was concerned about has nothing to do with ultimate repose. What has happened with the current law is when you have a beneficiary of the decedent's estate or a claimant against the estate has their claim disallowed or the beneficiary's not paid and the affiant in the small estate is not handling the estate in a proper or timely fashion, either the beneficiary or a claimant may petition the court for what is known as a summary review. And basically, that's a request to the court to order the affiant to do their job. And so the way the law is currently written is anybody who thinks an affiant is failing to perform their duty and wants to seek a petition for review, they have to file it within 2 years of the date of death of the decedent. The problem is if the small estate affidavit is filed, say, 2 years and 1 month after the death of the decedent, then in effect, both the beneficiaries of the estate and any creditor who has a claim in the estate is unable to seek a petition for review and have the court order the affiant to properly handle the estate. It doesn't place a time limit on when claims can be submitted. That's in another part of the statute, which says that a claim has to be submitted within 4 months of when the affidavit is filed. So, in all due respect to Mr. Bernhardt, I think he had some misconceptions about the way the statute worked. I would point out that the elder law section looked at this bill and had no objections to that provision. And although I have not spoken to the estate planning section of the bar, I'm pretty sure that they had seen the bill. They had no objections to that provision. And in part, the way it's drafted was largely at the recommendation of Dave Hendricks of the Legislative Council. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is I think he was seeing an issue which really doesn't exist there. And I don't know if that's too confusing, but...
Are there questions? What about the, again, my notes seem to spend more time talking about this certifying the copy of the affidavit.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chair Williams, I forgot you mentioned that. Yeah, basically what happens there is whenever a party files a small estate affidavit, frequently in order to get other parties, people who have possession of property of the decedent, have to send a certified copy of the small estate affidavit. A typical example of that would be when I pass away, if I have stock certificates in XYZ Corporation, in order to get the transfer agent of XYZ Corporation to take the stock out of the deceased person's name and put it into the next person's name, you have to provide them with a certified copy of the small estate affidavit. Well, Department of Human Services on occasions does file small estate affidavits when we have a deceased person whose estate is not being handled. And we do that so that we can get our claim paid. But then what happens is if we have to go to the court, pay a fee to the court, the court's got to process our request, make a copy, certify it, send it back to us, and then we send it out to whoever needs to have it. And all we've asked for was an amendment which basically says the Department of Human Services can certify its own copies of small estate affidavits which it files in a decedent's proceeding, such as this. This reduces our costs and administrative expenditures and so forth, and it reduces some of the additional work for the court. That's all that's about.
Okay, Representative Shetterly.
If I recall, there was just this sort of philosophical or policy objection, I think, raised as to why DHS ought to be able to certify its own copies when nobody else can. And, I mean, frankly, that doesn't bother me. But
My recollection was that Mr. Bernhardt's objection was basically he didn't think it was fair for DHS to be able to do it and nobody else.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I can, as I recall, though, didn't we, I'm happy to move this, but didn't we also talk about DSL, Division of State Lands, also doing these, and if this is good for one, should we also not make it
that
the Division of State Lands can also certify their own copies because they function in much the same way?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, now that you mention it, I do recall that there was some discussion about having somebody contact DSL to see if they would be able to benefit from that provision.
But they're not here.
But they're not here. It may be worth following through as it goes along just to see.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Going blind. Well, I'm just sort of waiting to see if I don't have any objection, committee. I mean, if we want to move the bill, that's fine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
What is the pressing need to move the bill? What is the what's the problem we're solving? Are we solving something that is a significant problem, or is this something that's a?
I think significant problem, Representative Jensen. I think everyone would have to agree that the answer is probably no. I mean, we're not balancing the school budget or developing a stable source of long-term revenue or fixing PERS or solving the $100 million hole we have in our public safety budget. On the other hand, we're at the request of DHS and the folks who have to do the recovery for state services that are provided to people who then die and they discover they've actually got some assets. And under this system where we try to deal and appropriate our resources to the people who don't have any assets first, and if you got an asset at some point along the way, we want you to pay back into the system your fair share so we can make the resources stretch farther. This is going to give them some additional tools that's going to make their job easier and more effective in that cost recovery approach to how we manage assets. And I think I probably, tell me if I struck the policy chord that you're shooting for.
Chair Williams, John, in a nutshell, this is basically to try to reduce some of our administrative costs in pursuing our claims, and in some cases trying to fix some holes in the system where we can be beyond you know, be more circumstances beyond our control, would be unable to recover our claims. So it would have some fiscal benefit to the Department of Human Services, but it certainly isn't going to solve the budget problems of the state.
So your point is an accurate one. I don't think that the world is going to end and these guys are going to keep doing their job if we don't move the bill. On the other hand, you know, part of what we do in this committee is tinkering with these small things to try to make the process more effective and to give them a better opportunity to do it in a way that's going to eventually create better administrative effect and more resources into the system. So, any comments, Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I understand everything that's going on surrounding this bill, but it doesn't appear to me that it is doing any harm, and it looks like it probably is doing some good by providing additional tools to the agency, and it seems to me that the mission they're pursuing is one we need to pursue, which is to allow them, where there are estate assets to be recovered, to reimburse what the state has laid out, that we should have the make it easier for them to do so. So I attach credibility to their request for these tools in the absence of any problems that seem to suggest we ought not act.
I'll take that as a motion.
I will move the we adopt House the
Dash one
amendments to House Bill 2150.
Okay. Representative McPherson has moved the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2150. Representative Shetterly.
No, just to echo Representative McPherson, I think, too, the discussion from last time coming back, not only are we dealing, at least on the margin, with ease of administration at DHS, but also we talked about the courts with this authorizing DHS to certify its own copies. That's as many affidavits as DHS processes every year, they don't have to file through the court system for certification. And that's, I think that's where we got to talk about DSL, too, that if they handle a similar volume, that on the margin, we're making things a little better.
All right. Comments? Representative Backman.
Are we on the Dash 1s?
We are.
Okay. I guess I'm having a little bit of a problem, and maybe you can help me with the Dash 1s. Where we're deleting on page 3, lines 1 to 28. It seems to me that's taking out the entire process by which creditors file claims with the estate. And what we're attempting to change in 4 is to change the time period, not for the filing of claims of creditors, but the claim of an affiant or a claiming successor who has not been paid in full.
Excuse me, Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I got to go grab my copy of the bill. If you could hang on just for a second, please.
Of course, by taking it out, all we're really doing is there's not a bill staying in law.
Pardon?
That was staying in law.
Right. It's just the bolded sub 4 that comes out, and this was the part that I think the court had an objection to.
Just sub 4 is coming
out? Right. Essentially, what happens is we just delete Section 3 of the bill, which maintains 114.540 in place without the proposed change that this bill would make. So it's just that bolded language that's going to go away, which was the new language the bill was proposing.
Why am I reading it wrong if it says delete lines 1 through 28?
Well, with what Representative Ackerman is saying here, I'm raising concern about the motion I just made. I do see this.
Let me explain, and because that's existing law, that's existing statute. So all we're doing is in Section 3, we're removing Section 3 from the bill, which means existing law stays the same. The bolded language is the new language, and we're deleting that section of the bill.
Right. If that was coming out within an italics,
would have been in bracketed italics.
My confidence in my motion is restored.
And my question is answered.
Well, that's a relief off my mind, sir.
Okay, so the motion is to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2150. Is there further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries and the bill is amended.
Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2150 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2150 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, Ann, would you call the roll?
Representative
Barclay?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Just
so hard. Jensen?
Confused. Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Zabrowski? Aye.
Representative
Cheddar? Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Is excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2150 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Prozanski.
I wonder if we can take just a quick break. I'd like to acknowledge a group of young people that are here. We heard through the windows earlier, there's up a group today, part of the Tobacco Prevention Education Program. The young people that are with us today are from Pleasant Hill Junior High, and they're here, as I said, as part of the group and talking about tobacco intervention and prevention for teens. So I just want to welcome them to coming to the Capitol today. It's the first time for many of them to ever be at the Capitol.
Well, great. We're glad you're here, and what you just saw transpire in this room is, despite how exciting Representative Prozanski explained to you what his job was, it's really much like what you just saw here, which is talking about colons and deletions and the like. So welcome, and we hope you have a good day here. We're going to go next to a work session on House Bill 2155, and I'll open that work session. If you want to stay in place, Council, you want to bring us up to speed on this one?
Sure. House Bill 2155 allows DHS to bring an action under certain circumstances to recover assistance paid to the recipients of public assistance. If you may remember, last time we heard this bill, there were some concerns regarding that DHS could bring the action after 6 months when the statute of limitations didn't toll for 2 years. This situation most often arises when someone is injured by an uninsured motorist and they have no incentive, or they are not insured, so they don't have an incentive. I'm sorry, let me back up. When they are not insured, they are injured, they do not have an incentive to bring an action because under statutory law, if they don't hold insurance, they're not entitled to non-economic damages. They would get their actual damages back, but obviously the big money is in the non-economic damages. If they don't bring an action, then DHS has nothing to file a lien against. This would allow DHS to go in and file an action. If you look at the Dash 1 amendments, I think we changed it so that in line 10, the period is no longer 6 months, it's 2 years. So,
I don't know that I have an amendment on 2155.
I have an amendment.
Does anyone else have an amendment on 2155?
No. Nope.
All right, why don't we have copies made? Okay. While we're waiting for the amendment on that bill to come forward for discussion, easier to talk about it once we get the amendment in front of us?
I'm not sure that it would make any difference, Chairman Williams. Sorry. I think I could explain it. It's pretty simple.
I think that's a statement about the committee. You better be careful. All right, then why don't we go ahead? We'll stay in work session. Why don't you explain to us what the amendment does?
Chair Williams, as the committee may recall, the elder law section did object to this bill, not because of the concept that we were pursuing, but because of the mechanics. And I recall that Representative Ackerman had a number of questions which I was unable to answer because of my lack of expertise in the area of personal injury law. While I think in many cases the fact that the client would be a necessary party that would have to be joined, one of our staff members had kind of an inspiring thought that we think may resolve some of those concerns. Ordinarily, under personal injury law, I believe there's a 2-year statute of limitations. And what this amendment we have here does is it prevents DHS from taking any steps until 2 years has passed. And that way, if the injured party has done nothing within that 2-year period, they, in essence, have already given up any rights to proceed with their claim. But what this amendment also does is it says that DHS at that point in time can move forward and go in and basically step into the shoes of that injured party, and we have an additional year in which to do that. Did I clearly enough explain that?
Yeah,
or
no, you clearly explained it. I think the concern obviously we have is that we create sort of a two-tier approach. So when a party believes, I mean, I guess my initial reaction to it is when a party would believe that their potential exposure on a personal injury claim would be disappearing because the 2 years had passed without them being brought into an action. If that person, which they would have no really basis of knowledge on, happened to be someone who was receiving services from the state and through DHS, they wouldn't know whether their claim really disappeared, because now that person could, now DHS could swoop in and assert claims that were they anybody else would have expired within that 2 years. So it creates this ability of sort of not having any real clear understanding as to when your claims disappear, not based on your risk, not based on anything you know, but based on the fact that somebody might have been a recipient of DHS services. So I have sort of fundamental problems with just how one manages risk in that situation is my first reaction. Representative Ackerman?
Yes, my reaction also is with my friend, the tort claim notice, in that if you did not become involved until after 2 years, the tort claim notice must be filed within 180 days of the accident, so basically you would not have any basis to proceed against any defendant who is a public body. So you're somewhat limiting your rights by waiting the 2 years, and a good claim may go bad.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, I think there were also issues raised by the estate plan or elder law section that are not addressed in the amendments that were good ones. The tort claim notice was one, but also the issue of what happens when the recipient is either deceased, and how this intersects with the role of the personal representative and the estate, and also if the recipient is incapacitated, and how this intersects or doesn't intersect with conservatorship and the role of the conservator. I don't know.
Well, I you're up on 2156, aren't you? As well, that's yours as well?
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe 2 for 3 is what you're going to get today, because I don't think the committee's inclined to move forward on 2155 with the challenges it's got. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2155. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2156, and we'll see how you do there. Fill us in.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2156 authorizes DHS to record in the county real property records a request that it be notified when a title insurance notified by a title insurance company when there's a change in ownership of real property in which a recipient of public assistance has an ownership interest. You may recall recipients of public assistance are often the subjects of financial abuse by others, and often have property that becomes transferred or which DHS could file against. And so this bill was kind of two-pronged, one to try and protect them against the financial abuse situation, but also at the same time make DHS aware of when they do come into possession of property. We have... I see that we have dash 1 and dash 2 amendments, and I believe that we should only be concerned with the dash 2s at this point, but maybe if you want to explain what the dash 2s do that the dash 1s didn't take care of.
Chair Williams, yeah, basically the dash 2 encompasses all the provisions in the dash 1s. We had a concern about the choice of the word sale in the dash 1s as being too limiting, and we requested that it the word sale basically be replaced with the word transfer, which would catch, you know, gifts and things of that nature as opposed to just sales. And I would add, too, that that the language in the Dash 2 was the results of some very close work with the Oregon Land Title Association to try to address any concerns that they might have regarding the original draft of the bill.
Okay. Thoughts, committee, on this one? I'm trying to recall what the... What concerns were on this one,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, again, I think the testimony from the elder law section was one about sort of making a public listing of people who are in distress by publishing by recording these notices, and the concern that that might have on making them targets to folks who might take advantage of their financial situation. And also, I think we had discussion this only applies to transfers through title companies, and it seems like a lot of the transactions that the department would be worried about wouldn't be transactions through title companies, but would be other than through title companies.
Right.
And so the question whether this was really getting most of what they were after anyway. That's at least a couple of things that came to my mind.
Rick, do you want to respond to...
Yes, Chair Williams, in regards to the issue of it getting to or not getting to all transactions, we concede that if a client of ours is going to just transfer something to another party without going through a title company, that this is not going to give us notice of that. But as a practical matter, we felt that although we could enact legislation that says that any transfer by a recipient has to be noticed to the Department of Human Services, I'm not sure that as a practical matter that's going to be enforceable, because when John Smith fills out a deed conveying title to Joan Smith and signs it and gives it to Joan, John Smith is probably either unaware that he'd have to notify us, or if he was being less than honest, wouldn't notify us. And so we just saw really no purpose in putting something into the law which, as a practical matter, would be unenforceable. But transactions that would go through title companies, obviously, we would then get notices of those. So that's why we focused on that. In response to the hit list, you know, certainly that's something that an unscrupulous individual could probably do. Similarly, if that person was unscrupulous, they could probably also ask for a list of everybody who's on senior tax deferral and pretty much get the same names. So I think that risk is already out there. I'm not sure that this bill would necessarily add to that risk. It would certainly give us a better chance of maybe being able to intervene, though, once we get notice.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Jensen.
Yes, at least according to some of the testimony that we received in the previous hearing from Susan Ford Burns, it would strike me that this particular bill is in relationship to the elder, somewhat in contradiction with the triple damages bill that we passed through the House this morning. Because at least if Ms. Burns is correct, and she cites an example where someone sells a house for significantly less than its market value, sells it for basically $24,000, the house went back on the market for $67,000. You know, and the accusation is made that this bill will slow down transactions, weaken the bargaining position of vulnerable sellers, and make our elders more susceptible to abuse that cannot be reversed. I'd have to have some convincing argument, I think, that that was not the case before I could support the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Well, I guess my sense on this one is, I recognize the need for DHS to try as best as it can to know about transfers of ownership or encumbrances on property where you've got a DHS recipient and you're monitoring it for purposes of recovery. And I think we'd be poor stewards of the public trust if we didn't try to help you do that in an effective manner to recover as much as we can, so you don't get people who are getting the value of the services we provide them and then turning around and not paying their fair share, given whatever their asset is, and allowing those assets to go off children and others as opposed to coming back into the state coffers for the value of those services. At the same time, I think the bar has raised some legitimate concerns. It would be my preference that you sit down with the Bar Association and the other law section and you figure out a way to work this out that could accomplish both the protection of these people from being identified as potential targets and address the issues that have been raised, while at the same time finding maybe some notice mechanism that would work. And I think that's, it seems to me there's got to be some approach that could be taken that could do that in a reasonable fashion. And I guess, and if not, you get a chance at some point to come back and tell us that you tried and there's just no other way to do it. But my sense is we're not comfortable enough with the benefit weighed against the risk to move the bill forward at this point.
Chair Williams, I certainly I would be willing to try to see what I can do with the elder law section. I know we've discussed this bill before, but I'm certainly willing to give it another shot. I guess I would want to be sure that I understand with some specificity exactly what it is that I need to try to focus on so that I'm not just sort of guessing.
Well, I think the testimony that was presented by Ms. Burns that we all have in our bill file would be a good starting point. And in the back is Joyce Patton from the State Bar, who's monitoring the bill and can communicate with the Elder Law Section. And I think engaging in a conversation generally with them about their concerns, and I'll ask counsel, perhaps they can identify them in writing and copy counsel, the committee, with those, and then you guys can try to work from there. That sound reasonable?
I'm willing to give it a try, Chair Williams.
I appreciate it. Representative Ackerman?
I have made one other suggestion,
yeah,
and that is, although the bill says that this notice does not affect the title to real property, it's not a lien or encumbrance, it could be a cloud on the title, and it might signal, perhaps, that the property might be subject to a fraudulent conveyance and could be set aside or something of this nature. So I think that has to be addressed because mortgage company might want to loan money on a place like this, and they look at that notice and say, wait a minute, is someone going to pull that back because it was fraudulent conveyance? Because some folks that are on public assistance will deed their property away just with a mistaken belief that they can avoid liens from your agency. So I think you have to worry or think about how you untangle that one. Is this really a cloud on the title that would prohibit legitimate transactions from going forward? My last comment, although no fiscal has been produced, I can imagine that the manpower in going through files and finding legal descriptions and filing these things would be at an enormous cost.
Yeah, I would tend to think that may be as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson?
Amidst all this negativism about the idea, I'd like to express a sort of positive note about what the agency is trying to accomplish here, and I want to encourage them to develop all the tools they need to in order to try to recoup some of what we spend out of the public fisc to support our vulnerable citizens. And sometimes there are people who, in fact, have capital assets and yet who are receiving public assistance. And if we can work out those concerns that were identified, I would be enthusiastic about this idea.
Yeah, I as well, and I want to make that clear. I think we do have an obligation to try to give them the tools so you don't have scofflaws moving through the system, drawing down public benefits when they have assets that shouldn't allow them to do that, or if they are doing it when those assets eventually change hands or someone passes, that the state appropriately gets access to those resources to pay back those costs. I think that's and we would be derelict in our duty. At the same time, I think it is a balancing set of choices in some of these bills, and I think we're right to send them off to try to work those out. So, anything else? Okay, we'll close the public hearing, or excuse me, the work session on House Bill 2156. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2342. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2342 eliminates the requirement that claims must be submitted no more than 2 years after the death of a decedent. The problem here, as I understood it, was that often claim would not be filed until well after 2 years after the death of the decedent. Sometimes estates would just sit not in probate because there was no reason to probate them, and that this was trying to address that issue. We have dash one amendments.
That's all I know about this.
Great. One.
You want to take us through this one?
Chair Williams, I assume we're referring to the dash one amendments. Basically, this is just a repeat of the same dash one for the first bill we discussed. This is in response, once again, to a request from Judicial Department that we eliminate a provision in the bill that would require the courts to go off of postmarks. And they had some real concerns about that. So it's just basically the same issue over again. Do you wish me to discuss the rest of the provisions in the bill, Chairman Williams?
Yeah, I remember that this is one where we had a conversation about the complexity of the DHS billing records that were used in the argument that this allows sort of an exception from the hearsay rule to allow you to use your billing records. Is that right?
Yeah, there is a clause in here, Chair Williams, that or a provision in here that was put in at the request of Department of Justice. One of the problems that the agency has frequently run into is that the current law basically says that you can't use the testimony of the claimant to prove the claim. And so what has routinely happened for Department of Justice is that parties seeking to avoid our claim will try to block the introduction of our business records into evidence by arguing that that is testimony of the department. And so Department of Justice recommended or suggested that we adopt language which is very similar to language utilized by the Employment Department and by Department of Human Services in cases where there are, involving child custody issues and termination of parental rights, which would clarify that, in fact, the departmental records are admissible in evidence. That's just simply an effort to try to reduce some of the unnecessary litigation costs when we have to pay DOJ repeatedly to argue that same point over and over again. We have, as I understand it, we've always prevailed and managed to get our records introduced into evidence. It's just that people keep trying to use that as a tool to block us.
All right, other questions?
Yes, I'm just back on page 1, section 1, where the claim is barred if not presented within the statute of limitations applicable to the claim. Can you describe if there's a contract claim, does that mean that I would have 6 years to file the claim?
Okay, let me think of it. I think the best way to, Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, maybe the best way for me to do this is kind of walk you through the whole process a little bit and try to explain how this fits in here. When somebody files for a formal probate of a decedent's estate, they publish notice, and in some cases they're required to specifically mail or deliver notice to potential claimants. a party who has a claim, a creditor against the decedent's estate, has 4 months in which to submit that claim from publication, or 30 days from when the notice was delivered to them in which to submit their claim. If they miss that, they still have an opportunity to submit their claim, but the risk they face there is that if there are insufficient funds in the estate, they don't get paid. Now, in the statute as it's currently written, there's also some other provisions which basically say the claim also has to be submitted within the statute of limitations time. So in your case where you're talking about a contract with a 6-year statute of limitations, if that 6 years had run on that contract claim prior to the decedent's death, then, yeah, they would be precluded from having their claim allowed or paid. And that doesn't change. The thing that's being changed here is there's also a provision in the statute which basically says that all claims have to be submitted within 2 years of the date of death. The problem that we've run into occasionally is where somebody doesn't know there's an asset, and 2 years down the road, the estate gets filed. And because it's been more than 2 years from the date of death, a creditor is then basically barred from submitting a claim through no fault of their own and totally beyond their control. And so all we're doing is we're asking that that 2-year restriction be removed. The restriction regarding statute of limitations would still be in place. The 4-month requirement would still be in place. The 30-day requirement would be still in place. And certainly when the decedent's estate is closed, once again, the creditor is going to be out of luck.
Thank you. That explains it for me.
I'm glad I was able to answer one question well.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Sherrill.
Thanks. I think I'm okay with Section 1. I still had problems, and I think I expressed them about Section 3, this sort of super self-authenticating provision for the department's records that appears in the probate code. It just seems a little odd. And I don't know. It's an awfully lot of language dealing with the authentication of department records and exception from the hearsay evidence rule under the evidence code just tucked into a statute in our probate code.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking down here to this end of the committee to get a reaction.
We're holding up the left side.
Yeah.
Shetterly comment.
Yeah, Bob.
No, I have another.
Oh, well, that's fine.
Thing.
All right, then make your point.
I don't have a point. I have a question.
Okay.
In my notes on this, I have a delete on Section 2, Sub 2.
I do, and I think that's what the dash twos do, is that they remove Section 2 from the bill.
That's my understanding, yes, Chair Williams.
Anybody else?
Well, I think we're in a... Excuse me?
I'm sorry, I just have the dash ones.
I meant the dash ones, right. The dash ones remove Section 2.
Right.
Of the bill. Bob, are you satisfied with the statute of limitations language? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Does the committee have a preference on this one? Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to just tell you, I don't have a strong sense one way or the other. I have concerns like Representative Shetterly about tucking hearsay exceptions in the midst of the probate code. And I guess I'm a little worried, and I need you to explain to me why this doesn't create a greater degree by removing the 2-year time frame, again, of putting the sort of the whole thing, you don't get closure because the claim can keep getting made, you know, the 2 years goes away, so there's this period of time where a claim can come in and be made. And part of this whole process is designed to sort of bring closure to the system. I guess I'm trying to figure out why that's other than the fact that it lets you go in once you found an asset, like, you know, any other creditor who is disappointed after they've settled their doings and then figured out that somebody had an asset. But there is a benefit to closing these things up and moving on, and I wonder...
Chair Williams, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, but I think, if I am understanding you, my response to that would be that when a decedent's estate is ready to be closed, once the estate is closed, then, of course, there's nothing for me to submit my claim to. So there is ultimately going to be closure, if you will, of the decedent's estate at that point in time when the judge, you know, authorizes the distribution and orders the closure of the estate. Is that responding to your...
Well, yeah, it is, except, but what's the policy purpose right now for the 2 years? What do you think the policy purpose was for the 2 years that you're trying to get out from under?
Chair Williams, my understanding, and I could be wrong on this, was there was a court case that came out of the U.S. Supreme Court, Pulse v. something, I don't recall specifically the name of the case, and what it got to in that case was the issue of due process, which a creditor of a decedent's estate is entitled to. In response to that case, there were some amendments made to the statute, and the person who drafted the statute, or the changes to the statute, I think had misunderstood something that was in that court decision and thought that he had to put this kind of language in there. And unfortunately, I could get you further information on that. I'm kind of working from hazy recollection. But that is why my understanding is that that's in there. I know that's not real clear to you, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the... to the extent we're changing this 2-year time period, I guess I'd feel more comfortable changing it if I understood better what the rationale was that it was put in there in the first place. And usually time periods like that are put into a statute in order to force the parties to expedite making whatever claims they're going to make about something to cause the process, you know, to move forward and come to closure quicker. So things don't hang about for years, whether, you know, tying up property and all sorts of other things. And I guess I feel like to just sort of change that in the abstract without that understanding seems to be taking sort of a big leap. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to volunteer if you'd like for me to take this on as a project.
Right.
Work with the department, find out if we can get a little bit more. I understand your uncertainty. The more I'm grasping, I get more uncertainty. And I also question putting hearsay in the middle of a statute that no one except for practitioners may know of, and it just seems like we should have it in a laid out in a different area.
Okay, you're the man, Floyd.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetter.
Well, I would just recommend then that the estate planning or elder law section be involved in this too, because we're playing with the probate code, and that.
Right.
I want to make sure we get more than just the agency.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll, since we have someone here from the bar, what we'll do is we can set up a time and we'll just see if we can't hash it out.
Okay, good. Then we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2342. Let me committee, while I still got most of you here, raise an issue. We have not scheduled bills for Friday. We have a number of bills that we need to address between now and the deadline. So Friday would be an available day to put some of those bills on. A number of them are member bills. The other option would be to just load up our agendas the remainder of the week. Representative Ackerman and I have a conflicting, and Przanski too. We've got a conflicting Legislative Council Committee meeting that's going on Friday afternoon. So it would be cumbersome for us to be popping in and out in order to make sure we maintain quorum and to get the work done. So I think it's going to be the chair's preference, despite the fact that we're in the midst of this hurly-burly, to just not schedule bills for Friday afternoon because of three of the members having these conflicting ledge council meetings. And it just means that we're going to have to lengthen our agendas between now and April 11th as we move into the next week.
You know.
You got one suggestion I do too, I can tell.
In the old days, we met occasionally at 7:30 on Friday mornings.
I was going to say, I'm not sure when we're meeting for the floor. It's probably 8:30.
8:30.
And I'm not sure how long it is. We may want to check and maybe, I was going to suggest maybe afterwards.
Oh, we got revenue.
Okay.
I suggest that you set all of Craig's bills at 7:30 on Friday.
Well, I used to do that. The chair Minnis would bring donuts at 7:30 on Friday morning.
And you'd have sort of an early, you'd have an early meeting in advance of any other meetings?
Whatever, yeah. It was 7:30 to 8:30, I think, was the...
Just a 1 hour?
Mm-hmm.
What was your suggestion, Floyd?
Mine was going to be after four, yeah. Before the 1 o'clock.
We've all got morning committees, or most of us have morning committee conflicts.
I come in early morning on Friday.
Well, you know what we may end up doing is instead of just a Friday morning, maybe, you know, we've got a Tuesday afternoon setting right now for the committee. Or Tuesday evening next week, mm-hmm. Maybe we'll add one morning setting and try to squeeze in an hour of a committee on one of the mornings. I know Tuesdays and Thursdays the Republicans have caucus, but that would leave us Wednesday, for example, for us to do an early morning setting next week as well to try to keep the agenda going.
Mr. Chair,
if
you maybe want to set the Tuesday agenda with these additional bills, and if for some reason we move through them pretty quick on Tuesday, we could actually... Continue.
So Tuesday and Wednesday morning,
and then have Wednesday mornings a backup.
Yeah, that may be a good idea. I guess you've seen the agendas. You know what we're trying to deal with. I think we've probably got more bills assigned in this committee than any committee in the building.
Save
the Ways and Means Committee. We're working very hard to try to accommodate as many members' bills as possible within reason as we move through this next week's agenda. And obviously, I'm going to be seeking dispensation from the Speaker's office to continue to operate beyond the date of the 18th, which is the date that's been sort of established for House bills, because we just can't do it given our current situation. So I just want you guys to recognize that we need, I'm going to need your help, a certain amount of flexibility. We may have to run longer into the afternoons for the next week or so, and you just might let your staff know that that's what we're going to do, and we'll do what we need to do to keep quorum. And if you have to leave, tell us where you're going to be, so if we need you on a vote, we can bring you back in. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and keep Friday afternoon open. Since three of us are going to be in the Legislative Council committee meetings anyway, it will be hard to manage that given the location and running up and down the stairs to get here. So,
sounds good.
Okay, thanks. We're adjourned for the afternoon.